From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made at an awards ceremony. Scholar Beverly Chalmers was being recognized for her book on the abuse women experienced under Nazi rule when an elderly Holocaust survivor approached her, held her hand tightly, and thanked her for telling her story. The woman said she could now rest in peace because her story was out in the world, available to be read forever. For 10 years, Dr. Chalmers uncovered the true stories of women who lived under Nazi rule. Her research spanned pregnancy laws, eugenics, euthanasia, and extermination. And listeners, I'll warn you, some of what we'll discuss this hour may be difficult to hear, but I'll tell you why we're having this conversation, using Chalmers' own words. She writes, quote, "The reactions of horror, grief, and dismay when encountering these stories leads many to downplay or neglect them, consciously or unconsciously, seeking rather to find stories of heroism, selflessness, and courage. Yet we owe it to the women who lived and died through this time to understand what happened to them in its entirety so as to honor them with respect and awe," end quote. Dr. Chalmers is in Rochester this week for several presentations, but first, she joins us on Connections to discuss her research, what we can learn from history, and how discussing the atrocities of our past can be painful, but also protect us from having to live them again. Dr. Chalmers, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is called Birth, Sex, and Abuse, Women's Voices Under Nazi Rule, and that's what you'll be discussing tomorrow night at First Unitarian Church. Listeners, if you'd like to attend that free event, it's a program organized by the Institute for Family-Centered Childbirth, and it kicks off at 7 p.m. Again, that's tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Dr. Chalmers, tell us what we can expect at your presentation.
I will be going through some of the major issues that are in the book that really does discuss women's birth experiences, pregnancy and birth experiences, and also their sexual behavior throughout the period of the Nazi era from 1933 to 1945. And I will look at both Jewish women's experiences and non-Jewish women's experiences, primarily the German women.
I think that's so important to emphasize because when we usually think about the Holocaust, we assume that the subject matter will be on Jewish women in this case, but you do. There are chapters in your book and sections that discuss what happened to German women who are not Jewish. And we'll talk about that this hour. Listeners, if you would like to join the conversation, if you have questions for Dr. Chalmers, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. Dr. Chalmers, this book was 10 years in the making, and yes. I know you've written extensively about women giving birth in difficult situations, whether those were political or social, but this book seemed to be a massive undertaking. What led you to pursue this particular topic?
A mixture of things. As you say, I've really dedicated my life to looking at women's childbirth experiences in difficult situations like in South Africa under apartheid, in the former Soviet Union under communism, women giving birth with having previously experienced female genital mutilation and now giving birth in our Northern American country or countries. And I turned to this, and also women giving birth in our part of the world under very highly medicalized situations, which are also stressful situations. But I had always been interested in the Holocaust and had read about it as a child and occasionally growing up. And then I kind of put it together and said, this was probably one of the most extreme, difficult situations where women faced giving birth. And I started looking at what was available and found that really this book had never been put together. There was no information. There were some articles, there were occasional, you know, particularly from the feminist writing, but not really focusing on reproduction. The women's experiences in the Holocaust were focused on their roles as wives or as breadwinners or as support for their partners or their children, but not as women giving birth, as mothers. And this was really my area of interest. So I put the two ideas together and decided this was something to explore. And it really was. It was the most horrific experience that women could have faced. Really unbelievably difficult experiences altogether.
How challenging was the research process for you? Why do you think those stories were so hard to find?
It was a difficult process because not a lot was spoken or written about by the women. And I've always been interested in what women themselves wanted to say, not just what us academics have written about women. I wanted to know what the women themselves said. And when I went back and looked at the testimonies that had been collected in the 1970s, 1980s, I realized that there were some, but very few, that focused on pregnancy and sexual behavior. And initially, I realized that many of these testimonies were collected for others to hear, especially their own family members or their children or grandchildren to hear. And these events around birth or rape or sex were just too intimate and too personal, so they weren't included in the interviews. And the interviewers were not able to ask about them. They were shy about asking about these questions. The Spielberg Foundation, the Shoah Foundation interviews did focus on that and did allow women to speak and encourage them to speak more openly. And for many of the women who gave these testimonies in the 1990s or so, 1980s, it was the first time they'd ever spoken about these events. When I decided that I needed to go back further and find writings that were more open, I looked at the writings that women had created even during the Holocaust in diaries, and then had written the memoirs that they had written soon after the Holocaust. And those were more open and more blatant about what they'd experienced. And after that, the literature was very spare, and there was very little available. So I decided to go back and find every bit that I could about the earliest writings of women about their experiences, because these were the most open. And that's formed the basis of the book.
How was it emotionally to take on this project? Because over 10 years, and you're reading all of these books, I'm sure it affected your family life. And I know that you read a lot at night before you went to bed, and that affected your dreams. Tell me about how that affected you emotionally.
It was always difficult to read about these experiences, but you slowly get familiar with the stories and with the events, and you tend to be able to deal with it. But I used to read virtually exclusively on the Holocaust and women's experiences. And I'd often read myself, going to sleep, and I'd pick up my book and read this. And most often I would come across anecdotes that I just couldn't keep to myself anymore. And I'd bump my poor husband and say, hang on a sec, you've got to listen to this. I can't believe they actually did this. And then I would read these snippets of the worst possible horrors to him, and then expect him to go off to sleep and myself to go off to sleep and leave him with his nightmares and me with mine. But he's very tolerant and very encouraging and very supportive of my work. So, and he's got used to me telling him these terrible things just before he goes to bed.
I know your own daughter inspired you as well in a way.
Yes.
As she was introduced to the subject. Tell us about that.
Yes. I have three wonderful daughters, but the one has been particularly interested in the Holocaust. And as a child, she started reading these books. She found them around the house and picked them up. And she read one, which was the story written by a woman who was a child at the time. And she was a young girl who actually saw her parents being killed in front of her eyes. And she survived the Holocaust. Obviously, her family did not, but she did. And my daughter picked up the story. And when she got to that section where this little girl talked about her mum and dad being killed in front of her, she put the book down and she thought, I can't read this. It could have been me. That could have been me, and that could have been my mum and dad. And I don't want to read it anymore. She put it down, and I saw it, and I just left it. And a few days later, she picked the book up again. And years later, I said to her, what happened, Donna? What made you change your mind? Why did you pick up the book? And she said, well, I realized that little girl had no choice. She had seen this happen, and she just had to exist. She had to continue, and she managed to survive, and then had the courage to go back as an adult and write the story and tell what had happened to her. She said, if that little girl had the courage to do that, then I owe it to her to read her story, and I have to have the courage to do that too. And I feel very much that we all face that situation. When you start to read the book, it's difficult reading. I must acknowledge that. It can be very shocking to figure and to realize what had actually happened to women. But I believe we owe it to the women to understand them and to know what happened to them. And it's a way of honoring them rather than trying to sweeten the Holocaust, as we often do, or trying to ignore these issues and theorize about them. Actually knowing what happened to them makes us more knowledgeable and more alert to these signs of when things are going wrong in a society.
What are you hearing from survivors? We talked at the top of the show about one woman approaching you at an award ceremony for your book and saying, thank you for telling me your story. Do you find that's common among survivors, or are some hesitant to still talk about their stories, or are they upset that their stories are out there?
In general, women respond very supportively. And like this particular woman, she was herself an Auschwitz survivor. She came to me and pulled her sleeve back and showed her tattoo, and I realized where she had been. And she had tears in her eyes and she blessed me and said, your work is wonderful, you is blessed, and now I can rest in peace because I know that our story, not only her own, but our story has been told. And that generally is the reaction of people today. I think as the Holocaust survivors are aging and are leaving us, there are very few left now, many of them have turned back to say, I need to tell what happened. And they want their children to now know, and they want posterity to recognize the events and the experiences they went through. And many more of them are turning to writing their memoirs. Of course, these may be tinged by time and society. I've seen that happen too. But most of the time, the more traumatic events are actually remembered almost word for word as they would have been recalled soon after the war. And many more of them are welcoming this and are facing these horrible stories and telling them.
Listeners, we will be talking about some of those traumatic stories this hour. So if you have young listeners with you, this may not be the right conversation for them, but we'll let you make that decision. And as we go through some of the points that Dr. Chalmers brings up in her book, we'll look at the systematic approaches that the Nazi regime used to try to create the so-called master race. And we'll start just with the idea of that master race. What did the ideal Aryan woman look like, and how was she perceived?
Let's just take it one step earlier than this. The Nazi ideology at the time was very much, Hitler's idea was to create a master race, to create a perfect Aryan race. The features that we typically think of as being the Aryan perfect person would be, you know, the tall, blonde, blue-eyed, Nordic characteristics that we have as a stereotype. And that was regarded as the perfect race. Any kind of deviation from that was regarded by the Nazis, by Hitler, as inferior and as least acceptable. And not eventually it became the idea that, first of all, we shouldn't allow them to procreate. We should sterilize them, the eugenics ideas. And by the way, that was not unique to Germany. North America and the rest of Europe was very much in favor of eugenic thinking at that time. We were, in fact, the leaders of eugenics at the time. The difference with the Nazi regime is it took it one step further. Instead of saying just that these people shouldn't reproduce, it was also said maybe these people are not worthy of living. And it turned into euthanasia, which no one else resorted to other than the Nazis. So this idea was that we should get rid of people who don't meet these perfect ideals, that aren't ill, don't have hereditary illness, don't have any disabilities, and don't look perfect. And at the same time, we should try to promote reproduction and birth amongst people who do have these features. And so there were two prongs there were in Nazi ideology. The one was to promote Aryan birth, particularly amongst the German women who looked the appropriate way, and to eliminate reproduction amongst people who deviated from that. And there were all kinds of groups of people who deviated, and Jews were perhaps the bottom of the pile. They were the worst and should not be allowed to live any further.
When we look at the ideal German woman or the ideal Aryan woman, and we talk about the Nazis promoting certain characteristics, women were awarded for giving birth to more children. The more children they had, the more respected they were in their communities. Tell us about some of the approaches that were used in that regard.
It wasn't only German women, because some German women didn't meet this ideal. Some also had hereditary illnesses or perhaps didn't have good work ethics, and these made them not fall into the appropriate Aryan mold. So it wasn't only Jewish women. It was the eugenics program was applied to all Germans, Jewish and non-Jewish. But what they did do to try and encourage births was to give marriage loans to people, to encourage marriage, to give special housing allowances and furnishing allowances, and to give medals of honor for women who had more and more babies. So if you had 6 or 8 babies, you would get a different kind of medal. If you had 10 babies, you got the real German Honor Cross. And those babies had the so-called honor of having Hitler as their godfather. And also, if it was a boy, of having that child named Adolf. So it was very much an honor. And these women were then saluted if they were wearing their honor cross and they walked in the streets. They had to be saluted by the Hitler Youth, by people around. They were given precedence in lines in shopping centers, or if they were in stores, they would be given precedence and have special places of honor at ceremonies and so on. So
I'd like to read a quote from your book about that, and it says, quote, "Some racial hygienists thought that a woman should give birth to 8 or 9 children in her lifetime. Lenz thought they should give birth every other year over a 30-year period and therefore have 15 children," end quote. 15 children.
Well, it's not that long ago since a lot of societies have done that.
That is true. But at the same time, certain aspects of women's lives are being curtailed so they could stay home and raise children. The university admissions, those were curtailed. Was it only 10% of women were, that was the quota?
And fewer and fewer. The ideal was that women's place was in the home, in the kitchen and in the church and with the children. And that really was what women were supposed to do. They weren't encouraged, they were discouraged. There were fewer places available for them to study further or to work. And they really were confined to the home. They were discouraged from trying to look beautiful, wear makeup. They had to conform to the German wife, the German housewife look. And that, except by the way, amongst Hitler's own personal entourage, where he really liked to be surrounded by nice-looking women. So there were contradictions in Nazi ideology all the way through, but in general, for the population, women were not encouraged to do anything other than be good housewives and good mothers.
So we look at that aspect of the systematic approach, promoting birth among certain types of women, and then discouraging it or outright banning it or exterminating others. And one of those methods was sterilization. And I think I read in your book 360,000 people sterilized.
Something like that, between 350,000 and 400,000 were sterilized.
And it's important to emphasize it was not just Jewish women, people with genetic disorders, mental health issues, gypsies.
Yes.
And others. So this broad look at that. But also pregnancy was banned.
For those women.
Correct, yes.
Yes. Well, if you're sterilized, you can't have babies.
Right, the other women.
But there was another a side effect which was kept quiet even amongst German society, was that if you were sterilized, you were not allowed to marry. And you couldn't even marry someone else who was also sterilized, which is an odd kind of thinking. But that certainly was the rule for most of the early years when eugenics was at its peak.
What was the rationale behind that?
Well, the idea of marriage at all or any kind of procreation or relationship was not acceptable. And certainly the ideal was that a sterilized woman should never marry someone who wasn't sterilized, because then they couldn't have children. But why it extended to not being able to marry other sterilized people is, for me, incomprehensible. But that's what it was for a long while. And for a while, the church went along with this. And then at some point in the mid-1930s, the church decided it would just go ahead and marry sterilized people if they wished to be together. But that was against Nazi ruling.
And then in 1942, a pregnancy ban was issued.
Okay. Things changed between the 1930s and the 1940s. Around 1941 or so, and the dates are always questionable, the decision was made to move from sterilizing unacceptable people, in inverted commas, to killing them. So the whole focus shifted from eugenics to euthanasia, sterilization to euthanasia. And at that point, the Jews were already being moved into ghettos. There was a conference called the Wannsee Conference, where the Hitler had outlined all the number of Jews that were living in various countries. The target was about 11 million. This was right across England and Europe. And that was the target to kill, because by this point it had been decided that the Jews and the Jewish problem had to be solved, and the solution to this was simply to exterminate all the Jews. And this was their first target. It probably would have moved on to exterminating all the gypsies as well and the homosexuals, if and once they had achieved the goal of killing the Jews. But at this Wannsee conference, it was decided to kill all the Jews. And in order to make this easier, Jews were then moved into ghettos. So they were moved out of their homes. Other people, German so-called Aryan people, were given their homes, and they were moved into the worst slum areas of the cities or the towns, and forced to live in unbelievably horrific conditions, overcrowding, a few families to one room, no facilities, toilet facilities, absolutely horrific, a lack of food, the diet was restricted, they were walled in to ghettos. And in those ghettos, especially in the Lithuanian ghettos, the laws were then passed that Jews could not procreate. They were still living as families together, but the idea was that they could not have children. So babies and pregnancies were banned, and any women who were pregnant at the time were forced to have abortions. Abortion was illegal for German Aryan women, but it was encouraged for Jews, especially in the ghettos. And so, yes, there were a number of ghettos where laws were passed where women had to have abortions. And it caused a huge concern for the doctors, because it was the Jewish doctors in those ghettos who had to do this. But this was, of course, against any kind of religious or social functioning at the time. It was against the values of Germany, which said, you know, women should have many children. And Jewish women wanted to have many children, too. But they were not allowed to. And they either had to have abortions or the baby had to be killed, which was against Jewish law. Who would do it? What would happen if they did a late pregnancy induction and the baby lived? Who would kill the baby? Very, very difficult decisions. And we have the minutes of meetings that were written at that time by the ghetto leaders and the ghetto doctors about what to do about these laws. And they reflect the huge dilemma, moral and ethical dilemmas, that these Jews faced in trying to implement this.
What happened to the women who may have given birth if the baby was killed? Was there any punishment for the mother?
Yes, the women were, and the laws that were passed about prohibiting childbirth in the ghettos also said that if a woman refused to have these abortions, then her entire family would be killed, not just her. So the pressure on women to have an abortion was huge. And the pressure on the doctors to do these was huge, because otherwise a huge group of people would be killed. So very difficult dilemmas.
How do doctors, German or Jewish, reconcile some of these decisions that were made when they've taken a Hippocratic oath, when it's their duty to protect their patients? What was the thought process behind convincing people, the brainwashing of the Germans at the time, and then, Jewish doctors being coerced into making these decisions? How did that all reconcile?
It's a very hard one to come up with. Jewish law does say that the life of the mother has precedence over the life of the fetus. So if the mother's life is in danger in any way by continuing with the pregnancy, by Jewish law, that pregnancy can be terminated. So at least that was one way of acknowledging. But there are deliberations by the rabbis at the time which indicate that whichever way you choose is okay by Jewish law. Either if you let the mother continue, if that's what she chooses, and if in the end that baby is killed and that mother is killed or her family is killed, at least you are preserving life and you're not killing yourself, which is also a commandment. On the other hand, if you do choose to save the mother's life and by terminating the pregnancy, you're also saving life. You're saving her life, which is also another Jewish law. So these were hugely difficult religious conflicts that the Jewish doctors faced, as well as their own thinking and feeling about what they personally would be willing to do.
What about women who arrived at the camps who were pregnant?
Once this became even more difficult for women. Women who arrived at the camps were screened on arrival. And initially, as they came, if for example, in Auschwitz, women were usually sent to Ravensbrück, was a women's only camp, and Auschwitz had a huge number of Jewish women. About 50% of the inmates of Auschwitz were Jewish. And as they arrived in as family groups the station platforms, they were sorted. And any of the old people were immediately sent to the gas. Any of the children were immediately sent to gas chambers. And any mothers with small babies, small children, were also sent with them. So women were screened as to whether they carried children or whether they looked pregnant, and they were immediately killed. A number of women who might have been pregnant did get past that screening. Perhaps they were in early pregnancy. It wasn't visible in any way. And they would then be admitted to the camps and registered in the camps. No one knows, by the way, the number of women who were sent straight to the gas, because no record was kept of them at all. So we know perhaps many of the train transports and how many were on them, but we don't know how many actually survived. So women who came through and were admitted to the camps went through a shower process and a whole process of humiliation, basically. But at that point, too, they were screened to see if they looked pregnant, or perhaps if they were simply obese and might have been misinterpreted as being pregnant, or if they had stretch marks, which indicated that they were fertile young women, they might also have been sent straight to the gas as well at that point.
And what about women who, how many women did actually give birth in the camps? That number is probably nearly impossible to know. But for those who did, what happened to their babies? What happened to them?
Okay, those women who managed to escape being seen as being pregnant and actually reached at the end of a pregnancy and gave birth, there were a couple of possibilities. They could give birth in the hospital setting, perhaps a hospital, that's a kind of a joke, a sort of clinic. The last figures I heard, there were about 30,000 women in the camps. There were five doctors, so-called doctors, prisoner doctors looking after them. So that's not much of a hospital or a clinic. But sometimes the doctors were able to move them at night into the clinic and where it was perhaps a little bit cleaner for them to give birth. In most cases, they would give birth in the barracks because they were hiding the fact that they were pregnant. So they would give birth in the barracks under just the normal filthy conditions of those barracks. And those babies were usually killed immediately. So there were two options for the doctors. They could either do an abortion if they found out a mother was pregnant. And one of the doctors in particular, Gisela Pearl, did this. But she would abort the pregnancies as soon as she found out that mother was pregnant. Other doctors would, and other mothers who did manage to give birth in the barracks, usually had the babies taken away immediately and either drowned or suffocated or given some kind of medication if some was available, but very little was available, some kind of anesthetic or poison to kill off those babies as soon as they arrived. But there was no way they could live. The babies would have been killed immediately and probably the mother with them if the mother had been known to give birth. So what the Jewish doctors tried to do in those camps was to get rid of the baby one way or another to save the mother's life.
You mentioned Dr. Gisela Pearl. Mm-hmm. She was sent to which camp?
Auschwitz.
She was sent to Auschwitz. And she was serving as a doctor in the camp, and she noticed fairly early on, from what I've read, that pregnant women were being brainwashed. The SS would tell them, "We will give you more bread. Step forward. Mm-hmm. If you're pregnant, you will have more resources." And she realized very quickly that was untrue. Mm-hmm. And she took it upon herself to try to help as many women as she could. She didn't have any tools to perform the abortions that you mentioned, but she spent the rest of her life after surviving the camps with that immense guilt. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about her story? It's not one I think many people have spoken about, at least I haven't read about it mm-hmm. much, but the impact that she had and the number of people she saved, I think, is understated.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she at first, when she arrived in Auschwitz, and it was actually Mengele himself who apparently spoke with her and encouraged her to get the pregnant women to step forward. He was obviously trying to find them to get rid of them. She didn't know that. And he would promise them to put them in a special camp where they would have extra, better conditions to live in and better rations, and they'd be given good care when their babies were born. And she believed this, and she encouraged all the women to step forward and tell them if they were pregnant. And then this continued for a while until one day she happened to be walking past and she saw where these women were taken to, and they were being simply kicked and beaten and tortured by the Germans, kicked around basically until they virtually died, and then were thrown into the crematoria. And at that point she decided she can never encourage any pregnant women to reveal her pregnancy, and she would do her very best to save the mothers by aborting those babies. She had no tools or equipment. She used to use her fingers and her hands to actually do a manual stimulation of labor and get rid of that baby for the mother. She says in her reports that no babies died, no mothers died from this, and many mothers did survive and went on after the war to give birth. She's a very interesting character because she moved to America soon after the war. She was able to escape and come here. And she tried to apply to become a doctor here. And her story is told in a very wonderful film called, I think, Out of the Ashes. And she was interrogated by a committee at the hospital to see whether she was acceptable, because after all, she was a doctor who had collaborated with the Nazis. She'd served as a doctor in the concentration camps. And at that time, very little was known about what really had happened in the camps. And she had a hard time revealing and convincing the medical committee that investigated her that she was not actually a Nazi doctor. She wasn't doing what Nazis wanted. She was trying to save mothers from being killed by the Nazis. And she had quite a hard time doing that. But she also, you know, she did. And she did serve as a doctor here for many years. Then she emigrated to Israel. And she did wonderful work there, too, and worked as a doctor in Israel for many years.
I like an anecdote that I read about her and Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt invited her to lunch, and Dr. Pearl said, I'm kosher, I cannot join you for lunch. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, that's okay, we'll have a kosher lunch. And they met, and they had a great conversation. And Eleanor Roosevelt could feel the guilt that Dr. Pearl had, and she said, let that go back to being a doctor. So... And then she served, I think she treated many people who were victims of the camps, many
yes.
survivors.
Yes, she did.
So a long legacy. Listeners, I'm starting to see your feedback come in. We have phone calls on the line and some emails with questions for Dr. Chalmers. She's in studio talking about her book, Birth, Sex, and Abuse, Women's Voices Under Nazi Rule. She will be a speaker tomorrow night at First Unitarian Church, speaking about her book. That's a free event, and it's a program organized by the Institute for Family-Centered Childbirth. Again, 7 p.m. tomorrow night. So we'll take our short break. When we come back, your calls, your questions, and more with Dr. Chalmers. Coming up in our second hour, when you hear the term food bank, do you consider it a pejorative? If the answer is yes, is it because of the stigma attached to hunger in low-income communities, or is it because of the ties that most food banks have to corporate America? Author Andy Fisher thinks the latter. He says, we've spent too much time and too many resources on emergency food solutions. He offers his own solutions. Next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking with Dr. Beverly Chalmers, and we're speaking about her book, Birth, Sex, and Abuse, Women's Voices Under Nazi Rule. We're starting to see your comments and questions come in, so we'll go right to the phones. This is Manon in Rochester. Go ahead. Hi, Manon. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. This is Manon. I'd like to comment that all cultures and religions use male domination to dominate and control women. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, all of these religions that I studied, I saw a lot of inequality and domination of women. Secondly, I'd like to say that Pakistan, the military especially around the world, use terrible sexual violence to attack women, such as the Pakistani soldiers who raped women in Bangladesh on this recent discussion on Germany. And also, I think Senator Gillibrand said that 26,000 women were raped in the military here in America. And a police officer raped a 13-year-old girl in New York. A police officer raped a 6-year-old girl in Pakistan. This is horrific. And I hope that all the women in the world will get together to prevent violence and rape against young girls and women. Thank you.
Thank you, Manon. Thanks for calling. I think you raised some important points. What can we learn about what happened in Nazi Germany? How can we prevent it? What are the warning signs that we can recognize so we don't see these instances happening again? And unfortunately, we are. And I know you've studied, Dr. Chalmers, you've studied childbirth and these relations in other countries under difficult situations. What do you think in response to Manon's call?
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right that rape is one of the things that we tend to see in these autocratic, male-dominated societies where women's roles are seen as inferior. And we do see this particularly in war situations, but not only. You raised a number of interesting things. The one is you extended the issue of rape of women to rape of children. And that's a particular interest of mine now that I'm moving into. And it is something absolutely horrific, which I'm seeing more and more of across the world. But you're quite right that rape is used not only, it's not just a sexual offense, but it is used as a weapon of war. It's used in some situations as the reward for soldiers, that this is your prize that you can get if you're in a war situation and you beat the opposition, the enemy. You can rape their women. And in another way, it's used as a way of demeaning the men of the enemy force. If you can rape their women, you make the men feel inferior, you make them feel less manly, they are no longer able to defend their women, which is the man's role in most societies, and you humiliate them. So rape is not necessarily only a sexual offense in these situations, but it's a weapon of war, and it's a way of humiliating and dehumanizing and demasculinizing, if that's the word, the men of the enemy group. So it's a very powerful tool and a very scary tool. And sadly, we're seeing it happening more and more often. The distinction between the Holocaust and other situations with regard to this is that the Holocaust occurred in Germany, which was probably one of the most sophisticated and well-respected countries of Europe and, in fact, of the world at that time, certainly the Western world at that time. And the Holocaust was implemented from the highest levels down by the politicians, the intelligentsia, the academics, the lawyers, the doctors. It was so-called based on a pseudoscience. And that's often distinctive from just a war situation where one is trying to capture territory. It was based on ideology, and I find that even scarier. And that rape occurred in that situation, and it was prolific both from the German side and from the invading Russian side when they took over from the Germans as well. It's a very scary tool that is used, and I agree with you. It's something we really need to learn from. It becomes even more scary when it pervades society, as you say, when a policeman or someone can rape somebody else or rape a child in non-war situations. That is becoming even more concerning for me, and as I gather, it is for you too.
You mentioned dehumanization, and I'd like to play a cut from a guest who was on this program in the past. His name was Paul Chappell. He's an Iraq War veteran, and he was a guest on the program last August speaking about dehumanization and how it protects the human mind from guilt or remorse, making it easier to kill people, and that's something that certainly happened in Nazi Germany. So I'd like to listen to an example of him talking about a thought experiment on how that works.
I like to do this thought experiment to show how the act of committing violence can traumatize people. So I tell the audience, imagine that I ask you to spend the entire day with a five-year-old girl, and your mission during this day is to get to know this five-year-old girl as well as possible. Find out what does she want to be when she grows up? Does she have a pet? What's her pet's name? What are her parents like? Does she have siblings? What are her siblings like? What's her favorite game? What are her interests, right? What's her favorite food? And then go to the park, spend the entire day getting to know this five-year-old girl as well as possible. Now, at the end of this day, I want you to look the five-year-old girl in the eyes, and without blinking or turning your head, I want you to take a hammer and bash her skull in. Around 98% of the human population will become traumatized from inflicting that intimate act of violence. But what if you don't spend the entire day with the five-year-old girl? What if you know nothing about her, and then you kill her? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you never see her face? What if you hit her in the back of the head with a hammer? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease slightly. What if you don't use a hammer? What if you shoot her with a rifle at 300 yards? The percentage of people traumatized will decrease. What if you believe she's evil, or you believe her family's evil, or you believe her family's subhuman, or you believe that her family wants to kill your family? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down. What if you drop bombs at 10,000 feet? Percentage of people traumatized goes way down.
Do you think we as a society, Dr. Chalmers, are becoming more effective at dehumanizing our fellow humans?
In some ways, yes, we are. I think the idea of us versus them has been with us for centuries. We certainly, in the Nazi era, this was used as a tool. And it's actually a tool that's used in all armies. The enemy is the enemy. It's not people. It's not a father who has children. It's an enemy. And all soldiers are trained this way, to think of the other as the enemy. So it's a dehumanizing process which is used in all conflict situations. In the Nazi era, it was used very, very carefully as well. As I mentioned, when women arrived in the camps, they were shaved, they were showered, but they were also shaved. All their bodily hair was removed. They were tattooed in Auschwitz. So that means their names were taken away. They were no longer a person with a name and an identity. They were just a number. And in all camps, people were given numbers even if they weren't tattooed. Their clothing was taken away. They were given rags to wear. Their shoes were taken away. They went with camp shoes, if they had any. They were simply turned into subhumans. That's how they were thought of at first. And, of course, Nazi ideology depicted Jews as not only controlling the world or the money controllers of the world, but also as licentious, as wanting to rape Aryan women, and worse than that, as an infectious agent, as lice, as vermin. These are the words that are used. And in other genocides around the world, similar words are used. Cockroaches. The enemies referred to as cockroaches, not as people. So this whole process of dehumanizing them, and verbally also in the Nazi era, they weren't regarded as people. They were first of all subhumans, and then they just became figure and pieces. So what should I do with these pieces, or what should I do with this garbage? They were simply dehumanized to the ultimate level, and the purpose of it was to make it easier to kill them.
That speaks to the psychological way of dehumanizing someone. But as Paul Chappell says, our weapons are advancing to the point where we can physically detach ourselves from recognizing a person as a person. Drone strikes, mechanization, different weapons. Mm-hmm. Does that scare you? What do you, as a researcher, what are you seeing from the past that's translating now? Where do you see us going?
Yes, absolutely. I think I quote Father Patrick Desbois. He's a Catholic priest who has spent his life looking at the terror and horror that was implemented by the Einsatzgruppen. These were the advance units of the German army that invaded the Russian front. And their role was to go in and basically to kill off the Jews as they went. And they committed some of the most horrific experiences, events of all. But Father Patrick Desbois has studied them in particular, and his comments at the end of this have been to say that he belongs, and I belong, to a race that kills two-year-old children. And I'm afraid he's right. And if we look around us, we belong to a people that are capable of killing two-year-old children, of raping them first. And that applies to all people that we regard as the enemy or the other. We are just able to do this. And the more mechanized we become and the more able we are to dehumanize the other, the easier that becomes to do.
Listeners, we're down to our last few minutes with Dr. Chalmers. We'll read some of your email questions for her. The first one is about eugenics. This comes from a listener who says, eugenics was huge in the U.S. both before and after World War II, often without their knowledge, poor blacks and single mothers and American Indians. Didn't the German eugenics movement come from the U.S. as an export along with concentration camps?
Yes, it did. In fact, America was one of the leaders of the eugenics program, and eugenics has been did continue in terms of sterilizing so-called unacceptable women who shouldn't give birth any further in our eyes or in the profession's eyes, but not only in America. It also occurred in Canada with our First Nations peoples, and it's something we ought to acknowledge, recognize, accept, and apologize for.
And here's a question from Mary in Rochester. She says, please ask your guests whether she found memoirs from any of the women living in the Lebensborn homes in Germany or Norway.
Yes, I have come across a few. They're rare. I think it's only one or two that I have come across. This particular woman that I remember, and it's a while since I read her book, she was brought into the Lebensborn family. This was one of the aspects of the Lebensborn and of the Nazis. In the countries that they occupied and conquered, they would seek out children that looked appropriately Aryan. And they would test them medically and check them out, because doctors, of course, were behind most of these actions. And they would be sent to the Lebensborn homes, where they would be looked after until they could be adopted. Lebensborn was also an adoption agency. And those babies were then adopted into German families, often SS families. And I have the testimony of the memoir of one of the children that had been adopted into or brought into, kidnapped basically, and brought into a Lebensborn home and then adopted into a family. And it was her story of how she went back to try and trace her roots, because of course their names were changed, their origins were changed. It was almost impossible to trace where they came from. So yes, I have come across that, but it is a very rare story.
Is that in your book?
Yes, I'm not sure. I think I did mention it, but very briefly, as part of the Lebensborn section, yes.
I would like to ask you about something that scares me. Yesterday on this program, we talked about a documentary called Unfractured about fracking in New York State and elsewhere in the United States. And Dr. Sandra Steingraber traveled to Romania a few years ago because there Chevron was trying to take over the land and start fracking in pieces of the land that were owned by farmers. And the members of that community fought against them. They stood up. They were pepper sprayed. They experienced a lot of violence against the police that were hired by the government to protect Chevron's interest. And Dr. Steingraber said, this is my country that brought this to Romania. My people, you know, brought these terrible acts of environmental harm to Romania. And your book makes me realize what we are capable of as a people. And down in our last minute or so here, what do you want people to take away from that? Knowing that, as you said, we are a society of people that can shoot two-year-old children, what do you hope people take away after reading your book or understanding your work?
Well, not only my work, but I would encourage people to read about what actually happened. We tend to soften and sweeten the Holocaust and other horrors. We don't read about it. We don't learn about it. And I would say, let's learn, let's face, let's read these stories, especially memoirs, so that we can become more aware of just what we're able to do, so that we are then perhaps better able to recognize the symptoms of when things are going wrong.
If you would like to learn more about Dr. Chalmers and her work, you can join a free event tomorrow night at First Unitarian Church. That's a program organized by the Institute for Family-Centered Childbirth. It kicks off at 7 p.m. She'll be there discussing her book, Birth, Sex, and Abuse, Women's Voices in Nazi Rule. We'll post a link to her website on our podcast of this episode. Dr. Chalmers, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're also speaking about, I believe, female genital mutilation at the University of Rochester tomorrow. So a packed schedule for you. Where can we learn more about your work?
Well, my website is probably the first place to go. I have a number of books about describing women giving birth in difficult situations, and you're welcome to see them on that website.
And what's your website?
It's bevchalmers.com.
Bevchalmers.com. So again, we will post the link to that website on our podcast for this episode. Thank you, Dr. Chalmers. Thank you for joining us, for traveling to Rochester a day early to be on this program. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And then thank you, listeners, for your questions and comments this hour. Stay with us. Next hour, we're talking about food insecurity and how we can solve America's hunger problem. More Connections next.